Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. As a reminder, this is an educational and grassroots program designed to restoring our Constitution. Many parts of these shows will refer to previous shows, and these shows build off of each other. That said, you will need to listen to all of these shows to garner what Republic Review is and how we can reclaim the Republic. Welcome to 2017. We've survived. Before I get into today's content, on this day, the state of Utah became a stakeholder of the Constitution. Big deal. And as a matter of fact, whenever I'm doing a show and when there's a state that's celebrating its birthday in the Union and the Republic, I'm going to let you know. You can go to my website and find out when your particular state is celebrating or should be celebrating its birthday. But I'm doing this because the states don't recognize and celebrate their birth in the Union or their becoming a stakeholder of the contract and the overseer of the federal government. And that's because they have an incorrect paradigm, and we're trying to fix that, aren't we? What we hope to accomplish this year in reclaiming the Republic is a lot. And let me start with this and how we need to do this. This begins just as the American Revolution. The difference between then and today is that our local elected leaders are clueless to the tyranny, or should I say, they know it's not right what's going on, but they have no evidence to really prove or argue that this is wrong, because plenty of politicians, lawyers, and bureaucrats are telling them, though, they can do this. They're supreme in all things. And anybody that's been listening to the show knows otherwise. And as a matter of fact, they can cite the authors of the contract who stated very clearly, not authors, even though James Madison was considered the author, all the framers that signed this and argued this, and they all put their pen to paper and went back to the states. And then the states accepted that and the definitions that they provided in those ratification debates. Well, they are the ones that have the say, not the federal government and these lawyers, bureaucrats, and politicians. So even though they may not have the facts, I'm here to teach them the facts about the Constitution and what happened a very long time ago. The first drift in our Constitution began with those lawyers or those professional lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats. And what they did, and I've said this before, they hid the facts and the real definitions of the Constitution. John Marshall deliberately obscured and never referenced and let them live in obscurity the ratification debates, because he knew, one, that this was a contract, because he was a participant of the contract review in Virginia during the ratification debates. So he didn't want to reference the ratification debates and how the Constitution was defined and how it was spelled out. There was a reason why he did that. And that way he could create this mystique of the Constitution and these mysterious clauses that are within it. These clauses are the Defense and General Welfare Clause, the Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. With these clauses, these lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats began inserting unconstitutional practices into the general government's arsenal of weapons to overreach and undermine the Constitution. Now, again, when you think about what they were doing with these clauses, they were using them in general speak to say, well, the Constitution says we're supreme in all things, and ignoring the clearly delineated, printed in black and white, that the federal government is only supreme in the enumerated powers, that the state is supreme in all other things. They completely ignored that. And then what they did, and John Marshall was very good at this, he kept on saying that, well, the federal government is supreme and can do anything necessary and proper that it deems. And that's how they've been able to get away with violating without the states really recognizing. And why is that? Because decades have passed since the ratification debates occurred and before the as such, the framers were dying off. And so nobody was really that smart because they didn't keep reading these things. And I've said this before regarding the, you know, good Christians who read the Bible all the time, they know what the truth is. But if you're not reading your fundamental principles, that's why I refer to the Constitution and these documents as our scriptures for governance, that if you're not reading these things, then somebody can come along and tell you what's there. And if enough people tell you that and they all collude in convincing you, then shame on you. It's your fault. Anyway, granted that these lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats acted as though they were noblemen. However, they were nothing but nefarious. And many, like I said, Marshall was one, and so was Hamilton, knowingly violated the Constitution and argued to violate the Constitution. Hamilton was the one that argued for the Assumption Act and the violation of the Constitution in 1792. These practices were injecting, and the very beginning of these arguments from Hamilton, Marshall, and others were injecting something that did not exist within the Constitution, and that something is case law and precedents. Nowhere in the Constitution or in the ratification debates was it ever stated or accepted that the lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats could use rulings or case law and precedents to shove unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers down the throat of the Republic. Several times I've said that this isn't about abortion. This isn't about immigration. This isn't about welfare. This isn't about all of these other distractions. Those are the symptoms of the problem. But anybody that really feels like this is about abortion, if you're clinging to one passionate issue, then the cure isn't the court system. The cure isn't, you know, electing your guy in to become a representative. It shouldn't matter really who you elect as a representative to the federal government. They're in a violent or a violation state, and they're not adhering to the contract. So if you really want to stop abortion from being considered the law of the land, then you would embrace republic review because it would take those powers back and give those powers back to the states. And to be honest, Washington was the first state that actually legalized abortion long before Roe v. Wade, I believe. But anyway, I digress. I know I'm giving you too much history into how we digressed educationally in the Republic. What I'm trying to talk about is educating our political leaders, like I started off with. And what has to be done is simple. Just like I said in the Revolutionary War, the elected leaders of the time of the late 18th century, these men understood the boundaries of what the British components and what British law was. They understood when they were being oppressed and when they were experiencing British tyranny, in other words, violating their own laws of impressments and so forth. And so what I'm trying to talk about is educating these political leaders in getting them to read these founding documents. A lot of these people that are already in office pretty much know this, and I'll call those people constitutionally literate. But there are plenty of elected officials, and if you put a Democrat next to their name, they're probably constitutionally illiterate, and that's why you hear Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, not anybody that has a Democrat next to their name, they're saying stupid things about the Constitution says this and the Constitution says that. I'll actually tell you that I've been in rooms with lots of Republicans in them, and I've heard plenty of Republicans say things like, oh, well, you know, we have a secular nation, the founders didn't want us to, you know, be a Christian nation. And these people really don't understand the history when they're asserting things like that, because if you read Federalist Paper number 2, John Jay was the one that said, we're all of the same faith. And he also said that you don't have to state the obvious, that we're writing the Constitution on paper. Why does the Constitution say that they're writing this on paper? That's because it's the obvious thing, and they didn't need to state that this was a nation that was founded on the Christian or Judeo-Christian principles. Anyway, so what I'm trying to do is give them and you an education in chewable pieces that refute the education that they've received and that you've received from the progressive education system. Once they read this information or hear this information, I believe the hard work is done. We just now need them to understand that because they represent us and take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and we need to hold them accountable to that oath. Well, again, I hear music in my ear, and it's one of my favorite songs. After the break, I'll tell you who this is if you don't know, because I've had a few people ask me, who is this? So we'll return right after the break. Please stay tuned. Thank you very much. Okay, well, we're back. I'm at the Parchment Press here, and I've had a few people ask me, what is that bumper music that you use? What's that music that you use on the show? And that is Stuart Copeland, and it's called Fanfare for the Common Man. I thought it was probably one of the most appropriate classical pieces that was redone, and as a matter of fact, it's being performed by a rock and roll group of the 70s, and this song was done by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Anyway, let me get back to what I was saying. As I was talking about re-educating and giving you, the listener, and the reader, and our leaders, our local elected leaders, and so forth, all of our elected leaders, the facts. I believe that once people start reading these things and understand that because they represent us and because they take an oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution, we can use that as a leverage piece. These are people, folks. These are people. And folks, all we need to do is use that leverage, because every person has the principles of perseverance or perseverance. So what they want to do is be able to maintain their job. Nobody wants to look for a new job. I know that when people start losing jobs, especially in government, you know, they're going to be running around trying to figure out how they can have income, because they probably are living a lifestyle that they don't want changed. They don't want to be thrown into the throes of, you know, living on the dole and being a recipient of the state welfare system. Anyway, when Madison and Jefferson stated in the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions that elected officials are duty-bound to protect us from federal tyranny, why aren't we using that? Why aren't we holding our elected officials accountable to that oath? So this year, I intend to begin the collection of signatures of petitions from these representatives, from our local representatives. Even though, and as a matter of fact, I'm hoping to get both started, but even though we have three levels of representation for us, and the Republic Review only really requires two of these levels to get kickstarted, these two levels of representation must be differentiated on and focused. And so we don't need to worry about the federal government's level of representation. The first and foremost that we have to really focus on is our local representatives. These representatives are easy to get a hold of. They're just down the street. They, you know, are in town. These representatives are the council persons, the mayors, our sheriff, and the sheriffs of the counties. And so, and that's only naming a few here. But the most important out of, as far as I'm concerned, the most important out of all of these, getting a signature would be the getting the signature of the sheriff. And that's because if you look at the sheriff, and for example, the sheriff of King County, how many legislative districts that go to the U.S. House of Representatives are within the within King County, or the same thing, L.A. County, or San Diego County. There's a couple of legislative districts. They only represent a portion, and the legislative districts that are a part of the state are even smaller than that. And so they only represent a very small portion of the populace, where the sheriff, he represents the entire county. He gets a lot more votes. He represents a lot more people. I don't know how much the sheriff of LA represents as far as people goes, but I'm sure it's in the millions, and it's well above the congressional districts that are, you know, neatly tucked within that county. Sheriffs usually represent, and like you given the example, they represent such a large number, especially in these common metropolises, that they actually swing a much heavier pen or sword. When they sign this petition, it means serious business. So when I can get a sheriff to sign a petition to call upon our state legislators to act, this means a lot more than if you and I, or we get 100 signatures, because that one signature and that one voice represents a quarter of a million people out here in the Spokane County, or however many are in Spokane County, or in King County, and so forth. So I hope to begin obtaining these signed petitions this year to begin creating this package to be sent to the body of our legislatures in the state Congress, or over there in Olympia. The second level that we need to focus on is those state local legislatures. And when I mean state local legislatures, well, we have some legislatures that are right here. So I'm intending on getting with them and others that, you know, actually take their oath seriously and will support and defend the Constitution. I'm expecting to go and talk to them and sit down with these documents and facts and let them decide for themselves whether they are going to take a stand against federal tyranny and protect the citizens of this great state. And I plan to make them aware and brief them and educate them. And I'll be honest, I'm going in with an expectation that they will sign this petition and petition their fellow legislatures to get on board. These petitions are designed to identify those who recognize our peril and the historical fact to the authority of the states and the necessity to their asserting this power and acting against federal tyranny. Those who will not sign the petition to defend and restore the Constitution should have to defend their position the next time they run for their office again. In other words, if you're going to take the oath, and you're not going to be taking that oath seriously and stepping up to protect us from the federal tyranny and protect our Constitution, then we need to find somebody else that will. The objective is getting the states to initiate, and you know, the race is on. I hope to see in 2017 one state start the initiating process of the audit so that we can get multiple states moving forward. Again, in getting a state to initiate this audit of the Constitution, I'm expecting them to do the due diligence and fact-finding research to prove, and I know they will because I've already done it, that the evidence doesn't exist, and to prove that the departments of Justice, Interior, the departments of Agriculture and Commerce, and the departments of Labor, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Transportation, Energy, education, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security are in fact violations of the Constitution, and that these roles and responsibilities must be returned to the states, or they'll have to amend the Constitution if the federal government wants to continue these roles, responsibilities, and powers. And to get this amendment, they're going to need 38 states. So again, I've said this before, there's that magical number of 13 that can keep, and I have a hard time understanding why, if the federal government wanted to create an amendment to establish or to keep the Department of Interior, I can think of a lot of states that look at the Department of Interior as an oppressive organization and an organization that needs to go, and that those roles, responsibilities, and powers need to be returned to the states, as well as the land of the states need to be returned to the states. And I know here in this state and the bordering states in the readout area, I know that getting these state properties, you know, rightfully back to the state or underneath the state's powers and umbrella is paramount for a lot of organizations in this area. So as the states start initiating this auditing process with their findings, they should be able to start sharing and uniting in one accord to assert their united authority. If by chance the states deem that a particular role, responsibility, or power is being best exercised by the general government, then they must recommend to Congress to write an amendment for their consideration. If not all roles, responsibilities, and powers, then they must be, if not, then all these roles, responsibilities, and powers, let me get this straight. I'm trying to say that if we've got these roles, responsibilities, and powers that we want them to have, then they got to amend the Constitution. If not, then these roles, responsibilities, and powers we don't want them to have, then they have to be returned back to the states. There's a lot of human beings being employed by the federal government that are within these departments. And I don't know anybody that says, hey, let's just, you know, axe them all. And in my first book, I talk about the human element and the humanity that we need to really consider in this process. And so I think that what we need to do is freeze their budget and basically just strictly start paying for personnel and start paying for the transfer of their information and what they're doing and so forth to go back to the states, and give them a sunset time frame or a milestones, you know, within the first 6 months, you get down staff to 25%, first year, 50%. And by the end of the second year, the doors are closed and that building is being sold and given back to, or what have you, because there's lots of buildings that are being used by the federal government that are not falling within the constitutional framework. And so those buildings can be sold. Again, my recommendation, many of these departments, roles, responsibilities, and powers that they're exercising already exist and can just go away. And so that's what I'm hoping for 2017, is to get these petitions signed and moving forward. And I'm going to keep you informed on how we're doing as time goes on. That's it for today. God bless, and we'll see you next week.